Now, with our housekeeping items behind us, I am happy to welcome today's moderator, Saramya Vaidyanatha. And she, sorry, she is the discipline leader for chemistry and ADME, representing adsorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion, and oversees the activities of the Chemistry and ADME Resources Group in support of the research at the Division of Translational Toxicology at NIEHS. Dr. Vaidyanatha, I now invite you to unmute and introduce yourself to today's participants.
Thank you very much, Dylan. As Dylan mentioned, I am Suramya Vaidyanatha. I am a group leader in the Division of Translational Toxicology here at NIHS, and I will be your moderator today. So first, it's now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Jessica Reiner. Dr. Reiner is a research chemist in the Biochemical and Exposure Science Group at NIST. Her research is focused on the improvement of analytical measurements of chemicals of emerging concern, mainly fluorinated organic compounds, through the certification of reference materials, methods development, and other quality assurance activities. Dr. Reiner, I will now turn it over to you when you are ready.
Thank you very much, Saramya. Before I begin, I do want to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk here. I've been a participant in the last two sessions, and I've found a lot of interesting information and learned a lot of stuff. So today I'm going to talk to you about NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the tools that we have and we provide for the analysis of PFAS measurements. So before I get into this, I do want to acknowledge all the different co-authors. A lot of this work has been done with the help of all of these different people for many, many years. And I do want to acknowledge that we, besides internal funding, we've had partial funding through CERDEP, or the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, for creation of our different reference materials and also creation of our mass spectral library. In addition to CERDEP, we've also had funding and assistance in the creation of our food reference materials from the state of Maine, specifically through their Department of Agriculture and their Department of Health and Human Services. So the National Institute of Standards and Technology, for those that do not know, is housed in the Department of Commerce, and we are actually a non-regulatory agency. Our mission is to promote innovation in the United States, and we do this by advancing measurement science, standards, and technology, and I will get more into that. Specifically at NIST, I am housed, and most of my colleagues are housed, in the Chemical Sciences Division. And the Chemical Sciences Division really tries to provide measurement services for a wide range of industries. These industries include clinical industries, environmental industries, and even the food industry. And we do this by providing what we call the traceability infrastructure for measurements of different chemical species. We also work on different technologies based on separation and mass spectrometry, and this helps us make our measurements better. So when I think about NIST, I think about our laboratory programs. Our laboratory programs are divided into three separate areas. We have our metrology laboratories. Metrology means measurement, so our measurement laboratories, our technology laboratories, and our national users facilities. I am actually housed in the material measurement laboratory, so one of our metrology laboratories are our measurement laboratories, where our goal is to help drive innovation through measurement science and measurement standards. So measurement science and measurement standards, when I think about it, I kind of can group it into what are called services for people. And we provide measurement services different ways. We create what are called reference materials and reference data. We also have user facilities, and we actually run quality assurance programs to help make sure measurements are good. Today, I'm going to focus on our reference materials and data, specifically on our standard reference materials and some of our data products for PFAS. And I'll also briefly touch upon our quality assurance programs with PFAS. So the first thing I want to highlight are our reference materials. So reference materials, or standard reference materials, are certified reference materials issued by NIST. These materials are considered homogeneous and well characterized, and they can actually help validate your measurements and improve quality of analytical data. We use these materials in different industries, like clinical industry, environmental industry, and food industry, to help support accurate and comparable measurements. So these measurements can be made with something that I like to call high purity neat chemicals. So these are our calibration solutions. These are solutions used to calibrate your instrument to make sure that your instrument's working well. But we also have complex matrix standards. So these complex matrix standards could be measurements of different chemical species in something like a biological fluid or a food or even something like house dust. At NIST, we have a wide variety of SRMs. So I've mentioned clinical and I've mentioned some of these natural environmental matrix materials. We actually have quite a number of human materials, and these include serum, plasma, milk, urine, hair, even whole blood. And our environmental materials include things like actual fish tissue or a muscle tissue or house dust. These materials have many measurements of different chemical contaminants in them, different elements like lead, vitamins, and metabolites. So I bring this up because these complex materials are super useful. So they can help a lab develop methods. So a great example is measuring vitamin D. So reference materials are super important. If you want to measure vitamin D and get the right number, you want to make sure your doctor gets the correct value for vitamin D, because if there has to be some sort of circumstance where you need to take more vitamin D, he wants to make sure that measurement of vitamin D is correct. Well, you send out your sample to a lab and you want to make sure that their method is actually good. Hopefully, that lab used something like a reference material to develop their method. They would take this material and actually use the analytical method in their lab and make some measurements, hopefully match the values on the NIST certificate of analysis so that they get good agreement and they know they're getting the right value, and then validate their actual method. And validation makes sure that they're getting the accurate value, repeatable values, and they're actually measuring the right thing. These natural matrix materials can also be used for quality control. So, with this vitamin D example that I've given you, an analytical laboratory can get back all of these different samples from people, and they can run these samples and they can run it alongside a NIST reference material quantified for vitamin D. And if that result for vitamin D in the NIST material comes out good, you know that the results in the own samples that you actually process alongside it are probably pretty accurate. So NIST has a lot of reference material. So that number two or three slides ago said 1,200 standard reference materials. These reference materials, again, are across that whole range of human materials, environmental materials. Well, in 2004, there was this publication by John Martin and colleagues that actually was discussing different issues measuring PFAS and why it's hard to measure PFAS. And one of the things they called out specifically in this paper was the lack of reference materials. So in 2004, NIST actually started working on measurements of PFAS in reference materials. And what we decided to do is to develop our chemical measurement methods on those existing materials that we were already selling. So between 2004 to about 2012, we developed different measurement methods to measure PFAS using liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry. And we were able to take these existing SRMs and add PFAS values to them. So around 2012, NIST was actually selling 10 different reference materials with PFAS values assigned on them that different analytical companies can use to help develop their method, validate their method, and use as quality control. After about 2012 until about 2018, we did a reassessment of what materials we had, and we looked to see where there might be measurement gaps. So in the data chart here, I show the materials we had available at NIST up until 2012. Something we noticed as a measurement gap was measuring PFAS in high-level sort of materials like what I have listed here as the AFFF, which I will go into in a second. What we also noticed is that we don't have necessarily PFAS measured in different materials like contaminated soil or contaminated food, nor do we have anything in low-level drinking water. So, starting in around 2018, 2019, we actually started to address some of these measurement gaps. So, again, I mentioned the PFAS and environmental matrices. So, this was really where we started our research in 2007. And we went back to our archive of materials that we were already selling, like our New York, New Jersey waterway sediment, our domestic sludge, our house dust, our fish tissue, and actually were able to make these PFAS measurements. Then, moving on a little bit later, we actually started focusing on these aqueous film forming foams or AFFFs. So, in 2019, we started working on this, and we actually developed four different individual formulations of AFFF. So, these actually have a wide range of PFAS depending on which one you purchase. And some of these different materials, one of these four, has up to 16 PFAS measured in them. In addition to having high quality measurements, we've also done identification of different PFAS using non-target analysis, which I will talk about a little bit later. I also wanted to point out that we've been working heavily on measuring PFAS in different food commodities. So, like I said earlier, there was this measurement gap that we realized that we needed to help fill. Something we're working on currently is measurement of PFAS in fish tissue. Our fish tissue is in production. So, we have a picture here of some of the old fish tissue we had. A fun fact is we put PFAS values on these fish tissues, and they started selling like hotcakes. So we ended up selling out of these fish tissue materials a little bit quicker than we anticipated. So that's actually why we're currently working on this new fish tissue. But in other food areas, we're working on different meats. So we have a bull cow, a dairy cow, and even a pork product. And these are all in different stages of bottling the material to making measurements of the material. In addition to those meat materials, we also did realize that plant materials had not necessarily been covered. So we've been working on different things like spinach contaminated with PFAS and actually corn silage. For those that might not know, corn silage is what's used to feed different animals like a dairy cow or a pig. In addition to the food materials that we were making, we actually have something that's called the Quality Assurance Program. And this segues into my next slide. And in this Quality Assurance Program, we've asked participating labs to measure PFAS in something like a freeze-dried milk product or a freeze-dried egg product. So I've mentioned interlaboratory studies, specifically quality assurance programs. But NIST actually routinely coordinates interlaboratory studies. And this is where participating laboratories are actually given a material, and we ask that the laboratories provide back data for the concentration of PFAS and other chemicals in this material. Quality assurance programs are slightly under the interlaboratory studies, and they're actually an interlaboratory study that provides the results but also feedback to the laboratories. So we know that some of these measurements, especially for PFAS, are very difficult. So we want to improve these measurements, and this feedback to the laboratory and discussions that happen with the quality assurance program really help us make measurements better across the country and across the world. So the qual I'm showing data here from an interlaboratory study that we actually conducted for measuring PFAS and AFFF. So four different AFFF materials were actually sent out to participating labs, and you can see the data here, and you don't need to see every little detail, but you can see that you have some data points here and some up here. These are the laboratories across the x-axis, and the green area in the graph is actually where the measurements are good, and that's what we want them to be. So you can see with this data, we get back that one of the laboratories is not necessarily in this green area, and their measurements might not be that good. So this helps us give them feedback, and we actually provide them a report. I do show the report listed here, and that can help all these different laboratories make better high quality measurements. So I do want to talk about a quality assurance program that is currently happening. So this year, earlier this year, as part of our food, nutrition, and safety measurement quality assurance program, three different materials were actually sent out to the different participating laboratories, and we asked them to measure PFAS. So we sent out some frozen meat, the freeze-dried milk, and the freeze-dried egg. So the data is currently being analyzed, and there will be a final report very soon, but we are already seeing that there are measurement challenges with some of these materials. And hopefully, the data from this quality assurance program and the final report will help laboratories make better high-quality measurements. Now I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about data tools that we have for non-target analysis. So NIST has three different data tools. We have what we call the NIST suspect list, and this is a list of possible PFAS that could be in a sample. We also have our NIST mass spectral library with PFAS data added to it. And then we have what's called the Database Infrastructure for Mass Spectrometry, or DIMMSpec. So I do know Jackie Bangma is going to talk about non-target analysis and suspect screening, but I'm just going to give you an overview of how I look at it in relation to the products that NIST provides. So there are a lot of estimates out there about the total number of PFAS, the total number of PFAS used in the environment, or found in the environment, or used in various industries. And it's estimated that there are over 4,000 of them. Unfortunately, we can only purchase approximately 100 standards, commercially available standards. So that really makes our traditional approach to measure one compound at a time very difficult if there are 4,000 chemicals and only 100 standards. So we have techniques, either non-target analysis or suspect screening, and these approaches help with the detection of these unknown PFAS without those available authentic standards. So, non-target analysis and suspect screening are slightly different from each other. There's a really great publication by Benchmarking and Publication for Non-Target Analysis Working Group at the nontargetanalysis.org website. But really, non-target analysis is broadly defined as the characterization of chemical co composition without the use of any a priori knowledge. So you have no idea and you're just looking for everything. Where suspect screening is more you identify the chemicals and chemical classes and you're comparing it to more of a predefined list or library. So I mentioned these two things. Sorry about that, my lights went out. Because NIST, under the guidance of Dr. Benjamin Place, started really working and thinking about standardizing and consistently reporting PFAS identification. So these are two really nice publications that NIST had a hand in doing. The first one is actually discussing speaking the same language. So, how we can accurately and consistently report novel PFAS that we find. So I said there's over 4,000. We want to make sure that when we find a new PFAS, it might not be listed someplace else. So this first paper really talked about the naming protocols and how to really structure the naming and chemical identification so that was consistent and that we would report novel PFAS when we see a novel PFAS. The second publication I wanted to point out that Dr. Benjamin Place also had a hand in was really a standard protocol to identify how confident you are in the PFAS that you're identifying. These are two fantastic resources for non-target analysis. So the first real data product, in addition to those publications, is our NIST suspect list of possible PFAS. So this This project actually built upon efforts from different universities like the Colorado School of Mines, Oregon State University, many, many, many others, to actually create a central location for PFAS identified by peer-reviewed manuscripts or documentation or computational tools. Within this suspect list, we've identified all of these different PFAS, and we attribute those identities to where the source was discovered. So, if Colorado School of Mines found compound ID number 4, we make sure that they have credit for that within our NIST suspect list. This is actually a great list because we allow public contributions. We don't require any chemical registration or any other entry point. And if you want more information, you can go to data.nist.gov or you can scan the QR code. The next NIST data product that we have is the NIST Mass Spectral Library. So people that use GCMS probably know about the NIST Mass Spectral Library. They might not know that in the 2023 release, we actually added 251 individual PFAS. So this now in our Mass Spec Data Center, we have a total of 865 PFAS mass spectral libraries. 161 of these new mass spectra have been added to our EI Mass Spec Library, and the other 90 are added to our Tandem Mass Spec Library. The third thing that I want to talk about and spend just a little bit more time on is our database infrastructure for mass spectrometry, or DIMMSpec. So the objective of this project was to develop the data analytic infrastructure to contain all this PFAS mass spectral information and the metadata associated with the detection of it. This is going to be and is an open database structure, and analytical laboratories across the world should be able to include this into their non-target analysis suspect screening workflow to help for the identification of unknown PFAS. It actually has a really nice front page, and what we want people to do is go to something like our Mass Spectral Match application, load their data that came off their instrument into the MS Match, and use this MS use their data to do a compound search to see if something that they're identifying in their sample has a compound match in the database. And they can do this and look to see how well the compounds actually match. So this should help with the identification. So if you have your sample and you have what's in the library, and you can see if the data overlaps and it's a good match or it's a bad match. In addition to matching like this, we also add fragmentation search so that you can build the different PFAS with the different fragments to make sure that when you identify something using DIMMSpec, that you're identifying the correct compound. So I know I flew through quite a lot of tools that NIST has for PFAS measurements. I've talked about the reference materials we have for chemical analysis. I've also talked about our interlaboratory studies and our quality assurance program. Finally, I talked with you about some of our data products, like our NIST list for PFAS, or our NIST suspects list is what we like to call it. And then also the NIST Mass Spectral Library, which has new PFAS in it, and DIMMSpec. With that, I'm happy to take questions. And if there are any questions that don't get answered today, or you have a question 3 days from now, feel free to email pfas@nist.gov. And if you want to learn more about the NIST PFAS program, because there is more than just the measurement science side of things, please click on the QR code. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. That was a very informative presentation. Participants, please go ahead and submit your questions by using the Q&A pod. We have one question that was very early on, Jessica, in your presentation. Question is, what do you mean by low-level drinking water? I think this.
I think I can answer that. So NIST does not have any drinking water reference materials, and we do know that EPA is currently trying to decide what the minimum drinking water level for measurements of, I think it's 4 different PFAS needs to be. And those values, some of them, 4 parts per trillion, is quite low. And it is quite difficult to measure at such low levels. So our goal is to make a reference material at those EPA values of 4 parts per trillion.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that makes sense. And our second question is, what is NIST definition of PFAS?
I don't know if we have a definition of PFAS. So that is highly debated across all the government agencies, and we actually debate it even within NIST. So I know that's not an answer, but to be continued, and we're waiting for guidance from some of our other federal partners.
Thank you. So we have the next question. When submitting our MS data to DIMSPAC, would it give us a confidence level?
If you're submitting data, that's slightly different than actually using DIMSPEC MS search. So submitting data, you provide your data to NIST, and you can choose actually from that paper how confident you feel with the data based on that. Now, if you use the MS search, then that's a slightly different thing. And then you can figure out your uncertainty analysis with identification as long as that compound was already identified in the database.
Okay, so I just want to add on a little bit and follow up on that question. Are there confidence level? How do you decide on the confidence levels? Are there some standards that people would use in the NTA world?
So I would direct you to the Colorado School of Mines paper because they actually have a really nice chart on it's almost like if you know this, then your confidence level is this. If you know this and this, your confidence level is this. And that's a really fantastic resource. It actually also has been used widely and might be one of the most highly cited papers of that year.
Okay, thank you. So our next question is, do USRMs have standards for total oxidizable precursors like TOP and no other total organic fluorines?
So that is something that we are talking about and considering. And it's more in the works for something like top assay that potentially can be subjective depending on how you run the assay and if you're getting everything fully transformed into precursors. For total fluorine, we've actually been discussing all the different type of methods you can use for that, like fluorine NMR, some of these CIC instruments that you can purchase. And we just have not decided exactly how we're going to do this. So what I did not get into is how we actually make these measurements. These measurements are consensus of multiple methods that are hopefully not, there's not too much overlap across methods. So something like fluorine NMR is very different than a CIC. And hopefully those two measurements help you hone in on the true value of what's in the instrument. So there's a lot more technical stuff that does go into the measurement side of things. But probably in the future, total fluorine will be included.
Okay, thank you. So the next question is about the how these SRMs for the tissues are made. So question is, how are the test tissue samples contaminated, meaning probably spiked, just exposed surfaces or perfused as an intact organism would spread the contamination? It affects the
So,
distribution across the tissue.
actually, these are not spiked in. These samples come to us like the fish tissue from areas that we know that there's a source of PFAS contamination. So they come to us, and especially for the biological materials, they're cryogenically homogenized, so homogenized below minus 140 so that we can mill them, processed, and then put into bottles. Even for the meat tissue, these actually come to us. There's a known source of contamination. So you get a whole side of a cow or a whole cow, to make the materials.
Okay. So the next question, I'm not sure whether it's related to you, but I'll ask it anyway. So why control of PFAS is unsuccessful in water bodies? So it's asking, the question is why we have been unsuccessful in controlling those PFAS in water bodies. That's how I read, kind of understand.
That's really out of my realm of expertise, and probably has to do more on some of the different industry sides of things.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next question. Does the NIST MS database also contain the replacement compounds like GenX and CIP, PF, PCECA? Like it's like an acronym for like a compound.
Yes. So we've done a thorough examination of the literature that's out there. And if people have provided those spectra in their papers, it has been included. And so I do know stuff like HFPO, dimer acid, or what people call the trade name GenX is included in the database.
Okay, I think the next question is about someone is asking for to repeat the confidence level reference, please, that you mentioned in Colorado website. So the person is asking for that reference, if you can say it one more time.
Give me
And then,
one second. So I am sharing this, and I do know my slides will be available. So Joseph Charbonnet's actual paper is the one that I'm talking about.
Okay, thank you. Thank you,
And
Leslie.
again, you will have the slides.
Okay, yeah. So the next question is on the techniques and extraction of the foodstuffs. How communicative are NIST and FDA in terms of the methods, i.e., works from Tim Bigley, Susie, Guinaldi, etc.?
Okay, so FDA and NIST are separate. FDA develops the methods to make some of these measurements. What NIST is doing in the interlab is just providing information back to the laboratories about how well their method is. So we talk with FDA about the chemical extraction method and measurement method to help make sure it's robust. And doing things like this interlab, if they've used something like the FDA method, we might be able to, depending on the laboratory, see where their data falls out compared to the rest of the data that's already been collected. So that will help inform those methods, but we don't write the methods.
Okay, thank you. So the next question is, what percent of total PFAS are included in the NIST list? So I'm guessing this with reference to your 4,000 total PFAS.
Yes. Oh, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I do know we have a lot, probably over 800. And the NIST Mass Spectral Library has 800 plus too. So those are two different lists with some overlap. So if you combined it, we're talking over 1,000 PFAS.
Okay, so I think so we don't have so next question I'm going to ask you is that I'm just curious on how long does it, I mean, you talk about the making different types of reference materials, I mean biological matrices, some standards, individual, how long does it take to make this reference material? For example, if you can take us through one in the biological matrix, what is that?
Yeah. So I'll start with something simple. So a calibration solution is fairly easy and might only take a year and a half. We get the standards, we measure the purity of the standards, we gravimetrically weigh it, and then we make chemical measurements using a separate set of standards to do that. That's pretty quick. The biological ones are a lot more difficult and can take 3, 3.5 years. So you have to get the biological product and you have to get enough of it. So that definitely takes a lot of time. That has to be, in the case of the fish tissue, cryogenically homogenized. So there are only a couple cryohomogenization units throughout the world. We do have one. And so homogenizing it, getting it bottled takes quite a bit of time. Then we actually have to make our measurements. I mentioned that we like to have two independent measurements, so we can hone in on the true value. For PFAS, especially because we know there are analytical challenges, we try and have more than just two measurements. We try to have four or five measurements. So it could take upwards of three years.
Yeah, that's a long time. So just to follow up on that, and you mentioned that, during your presentation that some of the SRMs that you had developed, you went and measured the PFAS levels, you added the PFAS, right? So how do you ensure the stability? There's a material has been collected a long time, and then you go and measure it, right? So, and also once you prepare the SRM, how do you make sure it's stable for that duration, and what kind of a steps do you have in place to confirm that the stability?
So before it starts, so we like to make materials that we can have for about 5 years. So we do stability assessments all along our measurement side of things. And while it's still being sold out to the public, we continue to do those stability assessments to ensure that people are getting the same values that they should.
Yes, so I'm just inviting participants to again add your questions to the Q&A pod, please. So I just have another question on the kind of a, how do you, like, I mean, as you can see, there are, PFAS or other contaminants, coming into the environment. And how do you decide on prioritizing which ones to make reference materials, right? Especially you mentioned 3 years, right? It takes that long. So how do you prioritize that as the list get, increasing and build up?
Yeah, that's a great question because we can't make reference materials for everything, especially something like food. There's so many. So it's discussion with stakeholders. It's discussions with people like the state of Maine and the FDA of what really is going to be a priority in the future, and where they see a reference material really being needed. The other thing we have are these quality assurance programs. And when we find big measurement challenges because of the quality assurance program, like let's take the eggs, for example, we realize that, a lot of people are having a hard time measuring PFAS in this matrix. Maybe we need to make a reference material so that we can get better quality data.
Okay, and I think we still have a couple of minutes for last question. And when you decide on labs to selecting labs to do these interlaboratory studies, and how do you go about like selecting labs or announcing that the program? And if you can speak a little bit on that.
Yes. So the Quality Assurance Program actually has their own unique website. And if anybody is interested in participating, they can contact the NIST Quality Assurance Program and sign up. So we don't limit it to certain laboratories. The only thing is so that people know you do have to pay to get the samples shipped to you. We will not cover the cost of shipping the samples. Otherwise, it is a free program and anybody can sign up.
Thank you very much. I think I'm not seeing, there's one last question. I think we have a couple of minutes. For biological specimens in human blood, always a better matrix than urine, especially for PFAS. I think it looks like it's a comment, more than a question.
Yeah. So with human biomonitoring in human samples, something to always be cognizant of is what is the right matrix to measure that compound in? So PFAS tends to accumulate in blood and those organs that have a lot of blood, but not necessarily urine. So I'm assuming that's sort of what they're talking about, maybe, I hope.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So now that, I think we are up for the next speaker, so we'll move on. Thank you very much, Jessica. Okay, so our next speaker, we have Dr. Jacqueline Bangma, a chemist at the US EPA in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Throughout her career, Jackie has investigated the impact and bioaccumulation of PFAS in humans and wildlife with the focus on alligators, fish, and the human placenta. Dr. Bagma, please share and begin your presentation.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you all so much for coming today. I am excited to talk to you guys a little bit about some studies that I am involved in. So today we're going to talk about the rapid assessment by accumulation screening study for PFAS in mice exposed to industrially impacted surface water. Now, the presenters in this series have done a really good job of introducing PFAS as a whole, so I won't belabor the point. This figure, I believe Lee Ferguson introduced you in his presentation a couple weeks ago, but I just want to highlight the diversity of PFAS as a class as a whole. So some which we have information on and others which we have little to no information on. And this graphic kind of helps portray that. And it was published in 2015. So that it's there's even additional subclasses of PFAS that aren't even listed here that have started to come to light. And something I want to mention is that since the move away from PFAS and PFOA, each new industrial manufacturer has shifted to a different chemistry and produces a unique set of PFAS. And even we find that even the same company at different locations across the U.S. will use different chemistries. Sometimes they're pretty similar, but they're still different. So it's from the manufacturing of these PFAS and where they make their way into products, they make their way into the water outside of these industrial plants because they come out of the effluent, and from there make their way into wildlife and in humans. And of course, this is where we're most concerned because it's there that they can cause toxicological harm. So again, because this class is so large, Jessica mentioned over 4,000 here, Wang et al. Estimated 3,000 in 2017. You know, if there's so many of them, how do we know which ones are in the environment and where in the environment? And how do we know which ones we should prioritize for toxicological testing? And the answer to that is mass spectrometry. Now, mass spectrometry is nothing more or less than the use of really fancy scales. And while they're a bit more complex than the average laboratory scale, they fundamentally tell us how much a molecule weighs with a really high degree of precision. So for PFAS, Aaron Baker did introduce targeted and non-target analysis methods. So I'm just going to briefly review. Jessica also mentioned this. But for the various methods that you can use for investigating PFAS, one of the most commonly used type method is a target analysis. And this is where you know exactly what you're looking for and you have access to a reference standard. So you can say, I know that PFOA may be here. I'm going to look for PFOA. How much PFOA is in my water? But if you want to cast a much wider net, you can do something known as non-target analysis, where you don't have to have any preconceived notion of what may be present in your sample. And so you can ask a question such as, what chemicals are present in my water? And you don't need reference standards for a non-target analysis. You can't necessarily get quantitative values, but you can get presence or absence. And the data typically is very large for these sort of data sets. And so you do need informatics. There are several types of non-target analysis that you can complete. One is suspect screening. This is where you do screen your data against a database of known chemicals, like the database Jessica talked about in her talk. Or you can do something known as NTA discovery. Now, NTA discovery is novel compound identification, where you look for compounds that may not yet exist in a database. So those are those emerging novel PFAS that have not yet been before observed. The difference between these two types of methods is typically the type of instrumentation that you use. For target analysis, low-resolution mass spectrometry is a very cost-efficient way to do a target analysis. It is the workhorse of the mass spectral field. And then high-resolution mass spectrometry is a more recent addition to the mass spectrometry field and is necessary for non-target analysis. Of course, it does cost quite a bit more than low-resolution mass spectrometry. Just to kind of give you an idea of the difference between low-resolution versus high-resolution mass spectrometry, it has to do with the mass accuracy. This is just a ruler example to really help visualize the degree of accuracy difference. The left side, we have our low resolution ruler where we only have tick marks to the 10th place. So here our mass of our molecule and our mass spec is down to approximately 0.1 to 0.5 Daltons. Now on our right, we have our high-res ruler that has a finer scale so that we can get down to a much smaller accuracy or higher accuracy. Now this ruler is not quite to scale for a high-res mass spec, but in a high-res mass spec, you can get down to 0.0004 Daltons, and that's 1 ppm. Now, the reason we typically need high-resolution mass spectrometry in order to do non-target analysis discovery is because of the complexity of data sets. Here in the graphic, you can see this is actually the SRM 2585 dust sample, and Jessica did mention this sample. So all the PFAS in this sample are already investigated and known. But you can see, if you look on the bottom, we have our retention time in minutes. And on our y-axis, we have our mass to charge. And that's related to the mass of the ion as it is seen in the mass spectrum. The size of the bubbles relate to how big the chromatographic peak is. So the larger the bubble, the larger the peak was in our instrument. And then the color indicates how confident we are in the identification of that ion. And blue is our unmatched or low confidence identification. As you can see, there's a lot of blue on this graphic. So if we're looking at a new sample where we don't already have PFAS quantitated, it can often feel like we're looking for a needle in the haystack if we are looking for PFAS. So in order to help us find those needles, we have a toolbox. So some of the tools that we use in our toolbox to identify emerging PFAS is looking for the most abundant peak. So in our dust graphic that we just looked at, those largest bubbles, those would be elevated for scrutiny. However, just because we've looked at all the most abundant peaks doesn't mean we've necessarily found all of our PFAS. So we can also screen for compounds that contain halogen, and we do that by using the isotopic signatures in the mass spec. So chlorine's a great example for showing you what isotopic signatures look like in our mass spectrometer, because chlorine exists in the natural environment in two isotopes, and those have to do with how many neutrons are in the nucleus of chlorine. And you can see here we have chlorine 35, which is 75% of the naturally occurring chlorine, and chlorine 37 is the 25% of naturally occurring chlorine. So if we look in our mass spectrometer, we get a unique fingerprint related to those two isotopes. The 35 being 75% of the signal and the 37 being 25% of the signal. And if we have a compound that has two chlorines, we get a even more unique fingerprint that is a combination of the two isotopes in combination. In addition to looking for isotopic signature, a lot of halogens contain something known as negative mass defect that comes in really handy. Negative mass defect refers to the difference from the whole number the mass of an atom is. So in a highly precise mass spectrum, we can ascertain that hydrogen is 0.0078 above 1, so it's slightly above the mass of a whole number, while our halogens are slightly below that of their mass of a whole number. You can see fluorine is slightly below, and then some of our other halogens are even more so below the whole number. So how that comes into play is when the mass of all the atoms in a chemical formula are added up, the actual mass our mass spectrum sees, you can see, can be slightly above 1 for a compound with 16 hydrogens, or slightly below 1 for a compound with 15 fluorines. So in addition to these tools, we can look for homologous series. Now, homologous series really helps us to fill out and capture all of the compounds, even at the lowest levels. And homologous series are a series of organic compounds that are in the same family, but differ by a common structural unit. So for PFAS, the most common structural unit is that of a CF2 unit. Here in this graphic, it's similar to our dust graphic that we saw at the beginning. Along the bottom, we have our retention time in minutes, and on the y-axis, we have our mass. I believe that's actually mass to charge, so similar to our dust graphic. And in a graphic like this, a homologous series creates a diagonal pattern that we can observe. And in fact, this homologous series is our perfluorinated carboxylic acid. So these are our legacy compounds. They're some of the PFAS that we have the most information on. But there are other ways to visualize homologous series. So here is one example, and I'm actually going to deviate just for a minute or two to show you guys a few more interesting series that we have seen as part of our work at EPA, because I know this is of a lot of interest to people on the call. But so here, Fluoromatch uses the Kendrick mass defect, which we talked about our mass defect, to help us visualize homologous series. And in this type of graphic, it's in a flat linear line instead of a diagonal line, excuse me. So you can see on the top here, we have our known PFCAs that we saw in our previous graphic, but below it, we have an unknown series that has a slightly more negative mass defect than the perfluorinated carboxylic acids. And when we investigated this series, we actually saw they fragmented to release iodine, and it ended up being that this was a iodinated perfluorinated carboxylic acid homologous series. Some of the other homologous series that we've seen, so this is from a industrial site that we investigate as part of a work at the EPA that has a lot of nitrogenous compounds. And you can see in the center of our screen here, we have our compound with the nitrogen, sulfur, and oxygen. And this ended up being one of our top, this was actually our third most abundant peak in our sample. And so it drew our attention immediately. And it was working with Jennifer Guelfo and Lee Ferguson. We were able to identify this compound as HQ115. HQ115 is a lithium ion battery, a counter ion for a lithium ion battery. And it has started to receive a lot of attention because it is a perfluorinated and also associated with green energy. But what is really cool is that Fluoromatch here helped us highlight two other members of this homologous series that were a lot more in the weeds in this sample. So we may not have gotten down to them since we don't always have the time to annotate all the way to the bottom of our data for some of our industrial sites. And you can see here on the top right of our screen, those two other compounds that are related to HQ115 that were observed in this sample set. Now, the two homologous series that I just mentioned are all related by CF2 repeating subunits, but you can find much more complex homologous series out there. And this is just a brief example of one of those complex homologous series that we have seen. This is yet another industrial site that we work with. And you can see here, it is a diprotic species, which means it has two functional groups. We've got two carboxylic acids, one on each end, and then we have two repeating subunits, each containing a ether. So this is just to give you an idea of the breadth of compounds that we see as a part of our work at the US EPA. And I want to say that in collaboration with Jeremy Komal and his team, that all of these compounds I mentioned today, plus some others, have been added to the newest versions of Fluoromatch libraries. So in addition to the homologous series, one last thing that I want to mention in our toolbox that is really key for non-target analysis is background filtering or having a background sample, because when targeted analysis, doing a method blank and doing a field blanks can let you know where contamination comes into play. But with non-target analysis, because the data set is so complex, being able to filter out your background is really key in helping you reduce your data set. So when we typically go out to the field and are interested in identifying PFAS point sources, we will create a study design where we collect multiple water samples upstream and downstream of a potential point source. And this way we can delineate the different compounds that were introduced upstream of our point source, and then anything introduced at or downstream of our point source. So with these samples, we can organize our data in a way to help us elevate these compounds. So this is kind of a combination of some of those tools that I've mentioned. So if you look across our bottom, again, we have our retention time in minutes. And on our y-axis, we have our mass defect, which is related to math, but remember it's the difference away from the whole number, and everything down below is of interest. And in this graphic, our effluent is our downstream sample below our point source, and then our blue is our upstream sample. So everything in orange or red, depending on how it is presented on your screen, is elevated for scrutiny in this particular data set. Now, this is actually data from the Cape Fear River in North Carolina. Jessica mentioned Gen X. A lot of people on this call may be familiar with Gen X or HFPODA. In 2016, Gen X did become a compound that a lot of people were aware of because this publication, Gen X, was one of the highest abundance peaks that we could see in the data set. And so it received a lot of media attention. But as our previous graphic just showed, there were a lot of ions in that data set that weren't just Gen X, that were likely fluorinated. So in addition to Gen X, there were quite a number of PFAS, and I'm just going to highlight some of the major players in addition to Gen X. So we had the monoether perfluorinated carboxylic acids. You can see those here. Gen X is one of those. Then we had the ether sulfonic acids. Naphthion byproducts are typically the ones in this group. And then we have polyether carboxylic acids. This particular homologous series is quite large. The ones that we see in the water are represented here, and some of the longer chain ones are actually observable in the soil and sediment. And then there's just a few other additional PFAS in addition to the ones here. So since many of these PFAS are emerging, standards often aren't available to purchase for toxicological studies. And since there's so many of them, even just in this one sample set outside of one industrial manufacturer, how can we prioritize them for toxicological, for synthesis and toxicological testing? My colleagues and I, you know, in the data in the literature suggest that compounds with higher bioaccumulation tend to lead to higher toxicity, and that is in part due to the longer residence time in tissues. So because of that, we should prioritize compounds that bioaccumulate readily. But again, we don't have standards. How do we know which ones bioaccumulate? And that is where we came up with the rapid assessment bioaccumulation screening study design. So from here on out, I'll refer to this study design as the RAS. But for this particular study, or for this pilot study, we collected water right at that effluent. This was the Chemours effluent that was in that 2016 publication. That particular plant for Chemours is called the Fayetteville Works facility. So we collected water, surface water there, and then we collected control water outside of the Cape Fear River watershed. To utilize this surface water that contained, or to utilize the chemicals that were in this surface water, we concentrated the water approximately 1,000-fold. And standards are not necessary for this process, but since Gen X did have a standard available at the time that this study was done, we decided to target a known level of Gen X just because it was available. So again, I just want to show you the compounds that were in this surface water with the Gen X highlighted here is the compound that we had a standard for. Now, since we didn't have a standard for any of the other compounds, and they're not necessary for this type of study, we are able to do something known as semi-quantitation. Now, semi-quantitation is, as it sounds, not fully quantitated. So we are able to estimate the concentration of these compounds by using the area under the curve of the chromatogram. So in our first graphic of our dust, those large bubbles, those are the peak areas under our chromatographic curve. And so we can utilize that information to estimate how much of these, how much PFAS is in the sample. So Gen X in this sample, we did have a standard for, so we have a known value targeted for when we do dose our animals. And that was 100 mg per kg per day of Gen X. We had several other compounds that were approximately four times the signal of GenX in our mass spec. We had several others that were approximately the same signal. So by semi-quantitation was approximately the same concentration. And then we had quite a number of the longer chain PFAS that were a lot lower had a lot lower response in the mass spec. So approximately 1/20th of the GenX signal. For the study itself, we had only a small number of mice. This was a pilot study where we took our mice and dosed them for 7 days with the concentrated water, either control water or the exposed water. And then we allowed for a 24-hour depuration prior to collecting tissues in order to let any of the compounds that may not bioaccumulate leave the animal system. After that, we collected liver and serum from each individual, and then we collected pools of both feces and urine. And these are the samples that we ran on our high-resolution mass spectrometer. So for this study, again, we don't have quantitative numbers, so we used a percent composition. And what we're really looking for here is the change in percent composition. Does something that is less readily observed in our dosing solution end up in a higher percentage in our tissue? So in our dosing solution, you can see here the orange and yellows, which are our monoether perfluorinated carboxylic acids, of which HFPODA or GenX is one, is about 80% of our signal or 80% of our dosing solution by the signal in the mass spec, with our other compounds comprising of less than 20% of the dosing solution. But if we look at our tissue, so the next four are our serum and liver results, and the last four are our urine and feces results. So we're going to focus on the serum and liver. And what we ended up seeing is that four of these compounds actually became some of the most concentrated or the highest percent of our tissue compositions. And that being I think the two biggest players really are NaFHM-BP2, which is this dark green, and HydroE, which is this nice dark purple color. And what's really important here is that these tissue results ended up mirroring blood results from community members that were located near the source of this water. This is the publication of those community members' serum results. And you can see that NaFHM-BP2, PFO4, and O5 are quantitated at the time this study was released. They did have standards. And HydroE was actually still found in 100, maybe 99% of the serum samples from the local community members. But because HydroE still didn't have a standard, it was not quantitative, which is why you don't see it here in this graphic. Because of this study and the community member data results, several of the polyether carboxylic acids have actually been synthesized and are now commercially available to purchase. And toxicological studies are now underway for PFO4DA and PFO5DODA, which I think is great and really important that it was able to help focus down on some of these compounds. So the question is, this pilot study showed that it really is a good way to start to understand and prioritize PFAS from a complex mixture of environmental PFAS that we have no standards for. So can we expand and complete a study like this for other PFAS mixtures? And the hope is yes, we hope that's our overall goal. The map here you see represents some of the sites that we work with as a part of our work at EPA, and they are potential locations for a RAB additional RAB study. So with that, I would just like to acknowledge all of my collaborators and my team members. And if anybody has any questions after today, please feel free to email me. And with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you very much, Jackie. That was a very interesting presentation. So we have some questions from the audience. First one is, have you tried using different high-resolution mass spec databases to identify PFAS? If so, do the different databases identify the same PFAS present in a sample? This is for the unknowns, probably.
So that is a good question. I actually don't use mass spectral databases. I do tend to use Fluoromatch, which is a is a database, but it's not a true mass spectral database. It's a generated mass fragment that Fluoromatch will compare against. And while it is different from a mass spectral database, it is quite large in comparison to a lot of the databases, because a lot of it is in silico generated PFAS.
Okay, thank you. So the second question is, how reliable is surface water sampling for PFAS in a river water body? Does it become diluted?
So that's a good question. I would say that a lot of the people I work with who work with surface water that is further away from a point source can have really dilute levels, and they typically see only legacy PFAS at high enough levels. But if you're close enough to a point source, you will see a lot of emerging PFAS.
Okay, thank you. So the third question is, are the iodinated PFAS, you know, PFAS with iodine in it, included in the NIST PFAS suspect list? How is EPA working with NIST to update the list as new PFAS are identified in the environment?
So that's a good question. I know we have a team member here at the EPA who works on with Ben to try to add compounds. They're working actually right now to add compounds to the NIST database. I don't know if we have standards for those iodinated carboxylic acids. So whether or not we are able to add those specific ones is different. So that's the difference between a true spectral database and having something like Fluoromatch, because I can add the iodinated carboxylic acids to Fluoromatch without having a standard, because I know the mass of them and I know their fragments. But for an actual spectral database, getting those standards would be one of the first steps needed to get a clean spectra.
Okay, thank you. So the next question is on your RABS study design, I think. How do you factor in all the various differences being found between species in how they bioaccumulate? How are those differences changing the models?
This is one of the first RAB studies that we've done. And so I tried modeling based on chain length, the number of esters, functional group, that sort of stuff. And the data set wasn't quite large enough to get us robust answers to that. We do find that long chain, but we don't have a definition of long chain and how that means bioaccumulation, because GenX, to me personally, I think is a decently sized molecule, but it doesn't bioaccumulate. But something slightly larger than GenX typically does bioaccumulate. But that's really just more of a experience from having looked at these compounds. But I can't say that with any degree of certainty for other classes of compounds that I have less experience with.
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. So participants, please go ahead and type your questions in Q&A part. So the last question on the Q&A part now is, can the compositional change in percentage from dose solution to tissue also be associated with precursor PFAS that has transformed?
Yes. That is a possibility, and that's not something necessarily that we can. Well, so since we're doing non-target analysis, we can understand if there are new PFAS that come as a result. So if like the PFAS that we know that start in the water, we can look for new ones in the organism. But if some of the precursors also turn into some of the same ones we're already looking for, we can't necessarily account for that. So that is a pitfall of something like this.
Okay, thank you, Jackie. So question on the concentrating the water samples. So when you're concentrating the water samples, you know, to be used in the URAB's design, what are the possibilities of losing semi-volatiles or some of the material binding to the supplies and things you use? And have you guys investigated that, at least based on the ones you have identified?
So that is a good legitimate question. I will say that the way we concentrate the compounds is typically the same way we measure the PFAS from surface water, even if we're not doing a RAB study. And so we tend to capture the same things that we see in surface water. That doesn't mean we haven't lost anything, but it is a very well-validated method that a lot of people in the PFAS water research realm use. And so we're relatively confident that we're not losing anything. I typically don't dry anything with any heat or go to dryness because smaller compounds tend to get lost when you do those kind of steps. So we don't go to dryness. We don't really heat our samples when we dry them down. But part of the way we control for that is we measure the dosing solution. In case we do have loss, we measure the dosing solution directly and compare it against the tissue so that we have a direct comparison of what the animals received.
Okay, thank you. So the next question on the RAPS design is that, so you mentioned the design is to look at the bioaccumulation. However, there was no time points in there, so you just had one time point. So how can you distinguish between the bioaccumulation versus distribution into a certain tissue?
So this isn't a super complex study, and it's not a true bioaccumulation where you measure multiple time points. It's really just looking for the biggest offenders that really build up quickly and stay in the tissues. Just the 24-hour depuration allowed for a lot of the other compounds that were not bioaccumulative, that were really high in our dosing solution, to almost completely leave some of the tissues, which it's a first pass to try to help prioritize the,
Okay, so I would like to invite the participant to please add your questions to the Q&A pod. So the last question I have is that in your true NTA, how do you deal with the isomeric compounds that has the same exact masses, right? So in the absence of standards, and how do you go about identifying that?
In high resolution mass spectrometry, it does still happen that we have compounds that are have different formulas but similar mass, but it's pretty unusual. We can improve our chromatographic separation if we are concerned that there are multiple compounds that are eluting at the same time. It just depends. And a lot of times before we do a RAB study, we do have some familiarity with the mixture of novel PFAS before we undertake a RABS.
Okay, thank you, Jackie. So we can take one last question before the next speaker. Doesn't the comment made about GenX being less bioaccumulative than the longer chain PFAS contradict the presumption of less bioaccumulative PFAS being less toxic due to EPA making the determination that GenX was even more toxic than PFOA?
Yes, it does actually, because it's not a the saying that a PFAS that is more bioaccumulative is more toxic is not true a true blanket statement. There are still compounds that will be more toxic even though they don't bioaccumulate, and GenX seems to prove that it is one of those compounds. So this isn't, of course, again, a perfect study, but it is just one way that we're trying to prioritize for testing.
Yes, in that absence of any data. Yes, thanks, Jackie. So I think that's all the questions we have. So we can move on to the next speaker. So we would hear from Dr. Itka Bekanova, who is an environmental chemist at the University of Rhode Island with expertise in analytical chemistry and environmental engineering. Her research focuses on emerging environmental contaminants, with a particular emphasis on the development of new technologies for the detection and potentially their remediation. Dr. Bekanova, I will turn it over to you now.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm going to share my slides here. Thank you for having me here today. And it's my pleasure to close this webinar series on tools for PFAS site characterization with an alternative approach, which is PFAS passive sampling. Thanks to Jessica and Jackie. I will skip the introduction of PFAS and I will go directly into the passive sampling. Before that, I would like to acknowledge all the partners and collaborators, especially Rainer Lohmann, who is the director of STEEP Superfund Research Program here at the University of Rhode Island, and all the students in Lohmann Lab who did most of the work I'm going to present here today, and also collaborators from EPA, Brown University, and USGS. So, as I said, I will jump directly into the passive sampling research. So, what are passive samplers? So, passive samplers are small tools which are usually used with, they are independent on power or other energy supply. They can be deployed in a range of environments. You don't need any infrastructure or very little infrastructure for them to be deployed. And they can be used for short or long-term monitoring. And usually they effectively reconcentrate pollutants compared to what we call grab sampling or spot sampling. So how the passive sampler works, so usually they measure what we call activity of pollutants, so it's either dissolved phase or bioavailable portion or gas phase when we talk about air passive samplers. And the way how they work is that they uptake the analytes by diffusion from the sampled media to a receiving phase in the passive sampler. And when we would think about how the analyte is it's taken by the sampler. So when the sampler is deployed in the media over the time, so in the first period, there is a linear uptake stage where the compound is accumulated in the media. Then after this first period, which can have different duration, there is a curve linear stage, and then we are approaching an equilibrium. So when we think about this curve, so usually passive samplers either work in the linear uptake stage of this curve or in the equilibrium stage. So when we want to derive the dissolved or gaseous concentration from passive sampling, we would use this curve, which is described by this general equation, but we can simplify it. So because we have two different kind of samplers. So as I mentioned before, the sampler which work in the linear uptake stage, we call these samplers kinetic passive samplers. And to use them to derive the dissolved concentration, we would only need to understand what is the sampling rate of the sampler and length of the deployment of this sampler. In contrast to what we call equilibrium passive samplers, which are leave in the environment until the sampler reaches equilibrium. In this case, what we need to know is water sampler partitioning coefficient and mass of the sampler or the media which received the compounds in the environment. So there are two different approaches when we are working with passive samplers, and based on the material or the circumstances, then we need to understand a different portion of the uptake curve. So where the passive samplers can be applied? So when we think about PFAS life cycle, there are many opportunities for the passive samplers. So for example, when we think about industrial waste think about wastewater treatment plants or like releases from the wastewater treatment plants, or landfill leachates, or in general in the environment, if we want to understand the levels of different compounds in the environment or how they're transferred through the environment to different media. And of course, if we want to understand the human exposure to various compounds, in this case, to PFAS. So why passive samplers might be useful is that I'm going to show you two examples of the studies where in the first study they were analyzed fish in six different rivers in my home country, Czech Republic. And on the left side, you can see concentration of PFAS in a tissue. In the middle is concentration of PFAS in the liver. And on the right, you can see information about PFAS in a passive sampler. In this case, there was a passive sampler named POSIS, persistent polar organic compound integral sampler. And you can see here, especially on this picture, that if we compare relative composition of PFAS in liver in fish exposed to PFAS from water and in the sampler, that the majority of the compounds has the same pattern. We can see differences, but I would say it's not ideal, but it is a promising approach. We did similar study here in Rhode Island. Actually, the study was done in Massachusetts, but in a we collaborated on this study with our colleague from Harvard, and there we exposed fish to water which was contaminated by AFFF, and the fish and with the passive sampler were exposed in what we called mobile fish lab. So you can think about aquaria full of water where we introduced fish and sampler and we measured concentration in water, muscle, and then the whole fish. We had male and female fish, and we also exposed there two different samplers. And in this case, we confirm that the patterns are similar in the whole body and the sampler which were exposed to the water. But again, this is not perfect because you can see that the similar pattern was also in the water. So we are not really, the samplers that we were used in this study can show that PFAS are accumulated to the sampler in the same tendency as to the fish. But again, the situation is not perfect. So I will talk about other passive samplers approaches in a few minutes, but I also want to show you when passive samplers are actually essential. So there are many global and local monitoring programs where passive samplers are already used, and they are usually used for other persistent organic pollutants to monitor their long-range transport, usually in the air. But we have also international treaties where we want to monitor the implementation of these treaties. One of the treaties is the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants. And until 2009, it was also only air which was monitored under this treaty. But because PFAS were added in 2009, at this time it was PFOS only, and for them, the water is the major medium for their long-range transport, the importance of the aquatic global monitoring network, it's essential. So What are the PASI samplers which can be used for PFAS? So we have different samplers which were developed over the last 2 decades for different compounds like pharmaceuticals, personal care products, pesticides, or even some metals like mercury. And here you can see 3 examples of this sampler, which were recently tested for PFAS. So you can see that for all of them, there are some similarities in the setup. So there are some diffusion membranes through which compounds of interest diffuse. Then there is, in some cases, we have even diffusion gel. And then there is a receiving phase. So, as I said, some of these samplers were over, let's say, last 10 years tested for PFAS. So the first one was, as I already mentioned earlier, is POSIS. So this sampler was originally developed by USGS for pesticides. And I'm showing you here results from the first trial when researchers from Australia tested uptake for PFAS over a different time period when the samplers were deployed in the water. So what you can see here is on the left is a concentration in the sampler in nanogram per gram, compared to a grab sample on the right for 3 different compounds. So what we can see is that the sampler operates in the linear phase for a few days. You can see for the hexanoic acid on the top that after 4 or 5 days, the uptake curve already is curving, so it's no longer in the linear phase. So you would need to characterize the sampler for both either equilibrium or linear, but it would be very hard to understand or to use this sampler for longer period and as a kinetic sampler, as I mentioned before. So there were other approaches. People try to use POSIS for some time, they improve it, try different membranes and upgraded the setup. But after a while, many of the researchers started working on other samplers. So one of them is DGD, which is a diffusion gradient in the thin film. And so for this sampler was originally developed for mercury and has many advantages, like that it only depends on the diffusion through the diffusion layer for mercury and many compounds. And people are currently testing this sampler for PFAS. So this was a study done in 2018 when the DGT were exposed to PFAS in very high concentration. And over here, you can see that it's linear, which is also sometimes a limitation for passive sampler, that the linearity over the broad range of concentration is not actually linear. So here they proven that the PFAS bound on the sampler are corresponding to the PFAS in the water. So these samplers were deployed in the water over a different period of time. So you can see here time in days. And there were 2 different samplers tested in these studies. So one of the samplers were with agarose, which I will talk about later as well. And the other is with like a polymer layer. So we can observe that the uptake of many PFAS, especially the small molecule like PFBS, is much more faster when we have agarose gel rather than other polymers, and that the PFAS uptake is linear for up to 20, in some cases, up to 30 days, which is what we want to achieve, because we ideally want to leave the samplers in the media for longer period to have a better understanding of what we call time weighted average, the concentration in the water over longer period of time. And here, when they compare the partitioning, the pattern of a grub sample and the concentration derived from the sampler, it was actually very close for many different sites when they deployed it. What we are doing in our lab is that we are modifying the DGT sampler, because all the previously tested DGTs had an outer membrane layer. And as we all know, PFAS are surfactants, so they tend to stick to all the surfaces. And when there are like layers, outer layer on the sampler, PFAS would sorb on it, and it would complicate the modeling of the uptake of PFAS is by the sampler. So here we have our prototype. There is no outer membrane. We only have agarose gel, where in the diffusive layer there is only agarose. In the middle layer, we have sorbent, which is incorporated in an agarose gel. And what we did, or one of our students did, was that he used these agarose gels to study the diffusion of PFAS through the gel, but also understanding diffusion of PFAS in water. Because we can manipulate the concentration of agarose content in the gel, and by diluting the gel, we can achieve something which is almost water, to understand better the diffusion of PFAS, not only in the sampler, but also in the water itself. So there is an approach when you stack on each other multiple layers of agarose, you spike one of the layers, and after a certain time, you separate the layers, you measure the concentration in each layer, and then, in this case, it was PFOA. You can plot the concentration in every layer and use this model to calculate the diffusion through the layers. So we are hoping that we will develop a passive sampler which would be useful for analyzing PFAS in surface water, potentially also in the ocean water, and by using the DGT sampler without any membrane. There are also other samplers which were recently invented. Again, a group in Australia, they started using micropulse polyethylene membrane sampler, which you can see here on the picture. So it's a tube in which there is again a sorbent. And they first tested it for groundwater, and it worked pretty well because there is no or very low flow of the water, which is usually the limiting conditions for good performance of the sampler. So they tested the samplers for up to 80 days. And for many of the compounds, at least for, let's say, first 30, 40 days, the uptake was linear, and it seems to be very promising approach. We use the same sampler here in Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island. So our former student, she deployed the sampler in collaboration with a colleague from EPA in Narragansett Bay. And then she extracted the sample and used sampling rates to derive concentration in the water. So what you can see here on this picture is that there is concentration derived by the sampler and the concentration measured by grab sampling. And for most of the compounds, there is a really good fit. We have some outliers which we still don't understand why the prediction by the Vasi sampler was underestimating the concentration in the water. But again, this seems to be a promising approach to characterize PFAS patterns and concentration ideally in the water sample. Our students, she also deployed at the wastewater treatment plant, and we used this opportunity to calibrate the samplers. So because the concentration of PFAS is at the wastewater treatment plant effluent is pretty stable. So when she deployed the samplers and left them there for 30 days, she observed very good like linear uptake by the sampler for almost all of the PFAS we analyzed. So I also wanted to spend a little time on how we validate a sampler in the lab. And I will talk about a little bit about the microbes polyethylene sampler, because I showed you some field data, but we also did some work in lab. And then I will talk about two equilibrium samplers, which we hope might be promising tool for biomimicking PFAS uptake by different organisms. So in last few years, we developed a laboratory setup so we can calibrate the samples in lab. So we have a tank, it's 100 liters tank, where we spike like environmental relevant but high concentration of PFAS, and we can change the flow in the tank. We can change conditions like pH, temperature, so we can calibrate the sampler. Here I want to show you the results from the flow calibration. So one of our students, as I mentioned before, that the P2 sampler worked pretty well for groundwater. There is no movement of the water, but we want to understand how does it work for water which move. So he did some modeling and also did many deployment of the samplers to understand that the flow here is an example for the hexanoic acid and hexanosulfonate. When he compared the data derived from the field experiment, from mathematical models, and from laboratory experiment, and we have really good agreement between what we see in lab from our own experiment, and also from the experiment from Australia from for zero flow. But there is also really good agreement when we are increasing the flow. So we can predict if we understand what is the flow in the environment, we can predict really good the what is the sampling rate for the for each of the compound. And good thing is also that once the flow is let's say high, then it doesn't matter how high it is. It's like that we have distinguished levels for groundwater, but then for let's say flowing water, the sampling rates are pretty similar. We also tested what we call biofouling. So when the samplers are in water, obviously the bacteria would biofoul them. So when we deployed biofouled sampler again in the tank, there are some differences, but overall there is no significant difference between, let's say, clean and biofouled sampler, which is great because we can then reuse the samplers, and the cost of this already very cheap instrument is even lower. I want to briefly talk about two samplers which we are also testing in our lab. One of them is based on the SPME fiber. So in the 90s, this was a rapid sampling and sample preparation tool. And so we use the fibers which are coated with polyacrylate, and they sort neutral molecules. So when we expose them to PFAS mixtures in the water, we can, and then quantify the partitioning, we can see a really good agreement with the carbon chain length of PFAS. So the tendency to sort to the fiber corresponds to the hydrophobicity of PFAS. What we also did was that we were modifying pH of the solution, and by using that, we can predict some PFAS properties, not only log K for the neutral molecule, but for example, also pKa. We applied the samplers in collaboration with our colleague from EPA in some studies when we exposed the fibers with embryos to the mixtures of PFAS. And there is, you can see here that the concentration on the fiber and the embryos are very similar. So we are hoping, and this is what we are doing right now, is that we are applying these fibers in our project where we are trying to understand bioaccumulating of PFAS in plankton. I'm sorry, I don't have lots of time for my last few slides, so I'm going to go through them really quickly. So last sampler we are working on is a prototype of nanographene hydrogel sampler. So we created this material with collaboration with Brown University, and it's really a sponge style material, and we expose it to PFAS in the water. And again, here we can see a really good agreement between, let's say, carbon chain length and the accumulation of PFAS in the graphene. What was not really promising was that for the short chain compounds, there was very little accumulation. So we improved this sampler by modifying the surface of the sampler. And on the left here, you can see that the accumulation of all the compounds, but especially the short chain PFAS, increased. And we also deployed the sampler in some contaminated sites to see if we can see the same patterns in the sampler as are in the water. So, and currently we are using this sampler in one of the projects of our collaborator, Kerry McDonough, to understand bioavailability and bioaccumulation of PFAS in sediment. So to conclude this, passive sampler can be useful if we want to understand the PFAS activity and transfer. We don't have yet operational sampler for bioaccumulation. We are working on it. There is still lack of field and laboratory studies to really understand the samplers. And just give you some hints on the future directions. I think we need to think beyond the water, like indoor exposure and food web exposure. And as Jackie and Jessica were talking about non-target analysis, I think it's a great opportunity to combine these approaches, passive samplers and the total fluorine or extractable organic fluorine tools together. So I would like to thank you to all my collaborators and you for your attention.
Thank you very much for that informative presentation, Dr. Beknowa. So I would like to invite the audience to submit questions to Dr. Ikka by using Q&A pod. I'll start with the questions I have so far. Do you know of passive sampling technologies that can be used in a drinking water application?
This is a good question. For drinking water, it's complicated because there would be different scenario if the water stays in the like it's stable and it's not moving, and different scenario for water which is moving. So and also the question would be why we would need to use, or what would be the need for using the passive sampler. So if people want to understand the levels, then obviously any filter would do the same job, and then extracting the filter would do the job. And actually passive samplers are very similar to the filters. But in general, as I was talking about the polyethylene tube, the micropulse polyethylene tube sampler, this would be the best option for water which is not moving.
Okay, thank you very much. So the second question is, what is the approximate difference in analytical effort and time between the passive sampling and grab water methods?
This is a great question. Thank you. So the thing is that passive sampler already does the work for us when we are thinking about pre-concentrating the sample. So if the environmental concentration, for example, when thinking about water, is high enough so we can analyze it directly, then we don't need passive sampler. But if we would pre-concentrate the sample, it usually takes few hours to pre-concentrate the sample and analyze it. When we are thinking about passive sampler, we only extract PFAS from passive sampler. So we are, and it's very simple, we usually use only some solvent to extract it, and the pre-concentration it's already done. So I think that this is one of the advantages, that passive samplers are easy to handle, but we also don't spend time when working with them.
Thank you. Perfect. So so in your opinion, you showed multiple samplers currently undergoing validations and already being used. So in your opinion, which sample is better for PFAS?
I wish I know the answer to this. I have been working on PFAS or in passive samplers for almost 10 years now, and PFAS passive samplers for 7 years, and we don't have like perfect passive samplers for all applications. We have certain samplers which work under certain conditions, but we are not there yet, unfortunately. I'm sorry, I don't have answer for this.
That's okay. That's why we are doing research, right? Yeah. And then next question would be, of the samplers, I mean, you showed that DGT sampler that uses the agarose gel, right? So is there some data on the stability or survivability of that under environment conditions for that particular sampler?
Yeah, so for this sampler, is the challenging part that the sampler, because it's agarose, that it's very fragile. So we are actually working on improvement, because the first prototype were very, very fragile. So now we are improving the prototypes, and also by adding some metals like copper, it might also prevent the biofouling, which might be also very dangerous for agarose, because microbes like to eat agarose.
Okay, so we have enough time for one last question. So we talked about the non-target analysis earlier, speakers introduced that. And are there any efforts going on to combine what your passive sampling and then involving NTA for the analysis?
I hope that there's going to be more and more, especially when thinking about human exposure. So as I said, passive samplers are something which can give us an information about bioavailable portion of PFAS or any compound which are in any type of environment, including, for example, indoor air. And combining this with the non-target analysis, it's a very powerful tool to understand what we are exposed to. So we are already doing some of it, but I hope there's going to be more and more applications and studies on this, like, promising approaches.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Bekanova. I think we are out of time for the question. But there is a couple of questions on the Q&A pod. Dr. Bekanova, if you can please respond to them privately, that would be great. I think, Dylan, the forum is yours now.
Yeah. Yes, thank you so much. Well, first, I'd like to say thank you so much to everyone for joining us today, and thank you so much to our presenters and moderator for joining us. Before we conclude, I would just like to remind everybody of the seminar homepage that you see to the left of the slide. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and more information about the Superfund research program. Also, there you will find a link to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. It's very helpful. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms offered to you via these webinar series. And you can also request a confirmation email via the feedback form as a record of your participation in today's event. Okay, and then also here are a variety of links to learn more about the Superfund research program. I encourage you to check out the various components of the website and learn more about the program and initiatives. And again, this slide deck will be as part of the archive for the first session as part of this series. And then I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter Tech Direct. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage and check out the monthly research brief and subscribe to the Risky Learning listserv for information about upcoming sessions. And you can also follow SRP on X, which is formerly known as Twitter. Okay, everyone. I would like to encourage everyone to, again, review the pages and archive of our last two sessions where you can watch the recordings from both October 6th and 20th and look through the different presentation materials, links that were shared, as well as slide decks. Also available on the screen is a QR code that you can scan that will take you directly to the webinar series homepage. And please do feel free to share these resources with any colleagues that were unable to join us today, or if you happen to miss any of the previous sessions. You know, we had a lot of really great presenters that gave up their time to really, you know, educate us all on the wide, wide world of PFAS. And so with that, it is time to conclude today's session and in turn this series. Thank you all for your participation, and thank you to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. And I bid you all farewell.